From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Beasts of the Southern Wild, a small movie that inspired Roger Ebert to write, sometimes miraculous films come into being made by people you've never heard of, blindsiding you with creative genius. Our guest is the film's director, Ben Zeitlin. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. John phoning in from Napa Valley this time. And the big news of the week, undeniably, is the election, John.
66.8 million people watched the election. That's down from 71.5 million in 2008. Big winner was NBC News, which won with 11.5 million viewers. And late at night, CNN passed Fox News, which I think is noteworthy. But I want to talk a little bit about ABC, which finished third for the evening, and Diane Sawyer, who kind of lit up the Twitter sphere with her seemingly random comments about the election. I'll give you a couple, and you tell me what they mean. Just before Romney was conceding, she said to David Muir, quote, "Yes, David, I know, and the land and the great continent of what might have been," unquote. And elsewhere on the program, she said, quote, "My grandfather used to prognosticate by the gourds he grew. He was very good in southern Kentucky," unquote. And as much as people were watching Diane Sawyer, they were tweeting about her, became kind of this parallel conversation, election on TV, coverage of the election on Twitter.
Yeah, I was watching for the first time that way. I had my smartphone in my hand. I was watching NBC and maybe skipping around a little. Then I see this conversation about Diane Sawyer, skipped over there, and a lot of people were speculating as to what kind of condition she was in. I think the explanation has been officially that she was tired. And I have to say, tap dancing for hours while these election results come in would tire a lot of people. And then I did go over to Fox because of this thing with Karl Rove, where he was on the phone with Romney advisors and challenging the call of Ohio for Obama. And it's really, you know, Fox has often been criticized. Its motto, fair and balanced, has been met with a lot of skepticism. And when you have someone who is the chief fundraiser for the GOP effort, who is challenging the news judgment of Fox, which to its credit called the election for Obama quite early and accurately, that is a peculiar situation.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Karl Rove. It was Chris Wallace who was anchoring the coverage at the time with Megyn Kelly. And he said, quote, "I've got to tell you, the Romney camp has real doubts about us calling Ohio." So the idea of a news anchor actually talking to the campaign and spinning its coverage, very unseemly might be one word, but odd is certainly, I think, an appropriate one here.
But going forward, John, Hollywood talked a lot about its disappointment. There was a lot of muttering and grumbling about Obama. But in the final analysis, Hollywood really lined up behind Obama. You saw fundraisers Jeffrey Katzenberg leading the charge here, George Clooney involved, Katy Perry involved, Bruce Springsteen involved, all kinds of entertainment people riding to Obama's side in the crunch, or the apparent crunch, if there was a crunch. And I think now Hollywood will hope that they do better with some of their very important legislative goals in the future.
Yeah, and top on that list has got to be the whatever version of the Stop Online Piracy Act or SOPA is in the House and the Senate. This is a disastrous experience for the White House, where they were trying to come up with some sort of formula that would curb online piracy. There was a huge kind of grassroots revolt from the middle of the country, and also companies like Google lined up on one side, whereas content providers like the Hollywood studios lined up on the other side. They ended up in a deadlock. Hollywood rightfully complains that it's far too easy to download pirated material on the internet. The internet companies, for their part, say that they can't have their users' free speech rights infringed upon. So the White House and the president has to come up with a better solution to these two competing agendas. And I think Hollywood gave a lot of money to the president because they want government to help protect their intellectual property.
I would lay more of the blame at the feet of the studios. I think they overreached in their proposed legislation. And when the White House had to choose between Silicon Valley money and Hollywood money, they went with Silicon Valley. But ideally, it should be a negotiated solution with some leadership from Washington, because it is a very big export entertainment and big money, and it's in everyone's interest to help American businesses protect their business. I know a lot of people who are supporters of internet freedom feel like everything that Hollywood would suggest is an infringement on their rights, but the fact of the matter is, stealing is stealing, and the studios do deserve some protection. I think we can all agree.
Well, it should be noted that Silicon Valley gave a lot to the Obama reelection campaign as well. So, like with any tricky political issue, the president is going to have to look at two ultimately competing, but I think in some ways sympathetic constituencies, Silicon Valley and Hollywood, and craft a bill that both are happy with. And that's going to be probably one of the hardest things he has to do outside of the economy going forward.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. And you can banter about Hollywood news on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Coming up later in the show, how the filmmakers behind Beasts of the Southern Wild used grassroots networking techniques from the first Obama campaign to cast their movie. Beasts of the Southern Wild made a big splash at Sundance, where it won the Grand Jury Prize. It won the Camera D'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in May and became an indie hit when Fox Searchlight released it in June. It comes out on DVD in December, and it is in the hunt for awards. Beasts tells the tale of a 6-year-old girl who lives with her father in poverty in the bayou south of New Orleans. This small family has no interest in evacuating, despite the approach of a massive storm.
It wasn't no time to sit around crying like a bunch of babies. We're gonna make a camp right on top of the bathtub. We got enough animals to eat until the water goes down.
Director Ben Zeitlin made Beasts on a tiny $1.5 million budget using unknown actors and dozens of local residents on his crew. Just 30 years old, Zeitlin started making movies as a child and found a group of kindred spirits when he was an undergraduate at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He and his friends explored their artistic visions in an abandoned squash court and accordingly called themselves Court 13.
Court 13 was actually just our address when we made the film college, because it was, if you want, that's where I moved, that's where I lived. So if you wanted to find
you
me,
you lived on a court.
So it was the squash court building.
The college was like, yes, go live on the squash court.
Oh, it was abandoned. It was like slated for demolition. So
okay.
And we were like,
did you
in
have
the,
a dorm room, or you just?
I got kicked out of my house for trying to make the film in my basement, and the fire department came and evicted me.
Okay,
you know, setting things on fire. So it wasn't unreasonable that okay. They came and just thought that we were endangering the safety of others. But so we found ourselves, you know, a more isolated balcony, I would
okay,
say.
So you have a penchant for living in abandoned places, it seems.
You know, it's a good skill to have if you want to make weird art. You know, paying rent is completely antithetical to waking up and doing what you want to do in the morning. So,
and so you had a group of friends, and that became Court 13.
No, it's never been like
wrong.
A group. Yeah, it's Court 13 is kind of an idea. It refers to the kind of way that our productions are, you know, sort of taking what would be normally considered like a community art project and then finding a way to kind of route that atmosphere and those structures into actually making a film, which generally is made in the opposite way of a community art project. So it's unhierarchical. It doesn't feel like when you walk into the only experience I've ever had on a film set, you walk into a film set, you feel like you're in either an office or a sort of military.
A big machine.
You know, a big machine. And never wanted to be a part of that and never really considered being a filmmaker until I started to figure out a way to make the films that didn't involve stepping into that lifestyle.
So you're in college, you're making films with this group of people. So what is the next step? Do you get a day job and continue to make things?
Well, I spent a little time sort of figuring out how to make it work. I went to New York and I actually taught an after-school program to first through fourth graders. So there was a movie-making class, and that was sort of how I supported myself, but not really. And I wasn't really able to make films in New York. And that was sort of what happened is I realized that I was spending all my time working and not enough time making things, and I pulled up all my roots and then went sort of looking for a place where I could move to and continue to make films the way that I wanted to, which involves absolutely no, you have to be able to live almost for free in order to make films this way because there's no money in it, you know. So I went looking for that in Europe and then ended up in New Orleans, and that's where it really started to work. And then sort of a lot of the team reconverged around New Orleans.
This is a group that worked on your senior thesis with you. Is that the core?
The core really sort of began during Glory at Sea, which was the first live action film I made. We found this giant abandoned house, and a lot of the way that short film was made is we would find people who needed places cleaned up. We were there 6 months after Katrina or so, and so both our office was in this big old egg factory. It used to be an egg factory, and the refrigerator was destroyed, and so they wanted to clear it out. We cleared out the refrigerator. We made that our studio. The same person owned a house. You know, we stripped walls, we repainted it, we cleaned the place up. And she said, you know, if you can clean it up, you can live there for a little while. And so that was sort of how things started. It was this huge place with 20 rooms. I could fit 50 people. So, you know,
if they're friendly with each other some degree.
Yeah, and that's the idea. It's these big, it's a big family and it's a lot of friends. And so we came down there and, you know, lived in that house and we're scrapping this movie together for about a year and a half.
I feel like I'm hearing something from the 60s. I mean, you feel so absolutely out of sync with the world that we're in today, the MBA world. It's like...
What's an MBA?
I actually don't know. Ask me. It's a business degree.
Okay.
Yeah, a master's.
No. I didn't get one of those.
No, you didn't, apparently. But I'm wondering if you ever feel that, you know, like what I'm doing is really different from what a lot of other people are doing. I mean, do you feel somewhat extraordinary that way?
I feel like I've found a place where there's a lot of other people like that in New Orleans. It's one of the things I love about it. It's a very, you know, you can know someone for 10 years and not have any idea what they're due for money or where they went to school. You know, in New York, I did notice that when I got out of, especially the end of school and living in New York with this very sort of professionally focused world that I needed to get out of. And I think I've sort of found a place where I feel like I fit in, so I don't feel like a crazy person or anything.
So the short film Glory at Sea, was that like the first post-graduation project that you would say was a real movie?
I made a couple things with the kids in New York, and I made another animated film in New York. But that was a big transition because it was the first time I'd ever done a big film with people in it. You know, it was a live-action film. It was a gigantic – I mean, it was this little project that spiraled completely out of control. It started off as a five-minute short with the $7,000 that I'd saved up from teaching the kids and turned into this year-and-a-half, 25-minute, $100,000 short film that involved everybody I've ever known. So it was this huge kind of life-changing, spiraling event that happened. Yeah.
And how do you keep financing it as you go?
I took out a bunch of credit cards.
Oh,
I maxed them all out.
You maxed out the credit card story, yeah. I always wonder how people find the nerve to do that, because that would just really scare me a lot.
Well, you get in deep enough and there's no way out. So it's that was part of it. I mean, we were in so deep that we had to finish the film if we were going to be able to continue our lives in any way. We would shoot, we'd run out of money, and then we'd stop, and then we'd either get more credit cards, or we had a couple of sort of angelic people come in. My collaborator Ray Tintori's film went to Sundance during that time and was very successful, and that sort of allowed us to finance the end of the film. It was things like that where, you know, we'd shoot as long as we could and then we'd stop, and months would go by, we'd be trying to raise the money and we'd start again. It was shot in about four or five different shoots.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with filmmaker Ben Zeitlin, who co-wrote and directed Beasts of the Southern Wild. He's been talking about the making of his 2008 short film, Glory at Sea, which premiered in New Orleans and was chosen to screen at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Unfortunately, Zeitlin missed it.
What happened was on the way to South by Southwest, as we were driving there, I got in a horrible car accident, turned my leg around, shattered my pelvis, and so spent that film festival in the hospital. And then, you know, as I was basically that film did well at South by Southwest, it got picked up at other film festivals. And as I was recovering,
you were not there.
I was in the hospital. Yeah. Well, I got to the last screening, which was really funny because I was in such a crazy wheelchair because of the nature of my injuries that all this publicity came out that I'd been paralyzed.
Oh, no.
It was like paralyzed filmmaker, blah, 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 which was actually great for the movie.
Even though completely untrue.
Yeah.
Right.
It was such a unbelievable, insane couple years making that film that it was almost like someone had sort of reached down from above and told me, take a break. So I lay in bed for about 6 months. And over that time, I got a settlement from the car accident that paid off my credit cards.
This is such a weird story.
it was really strange time, you know, and I had to go because I had no way of supporting myself. So I had to go home and basically recover in New York. And when I was really wanted to be living in New Orleans, and that actually is where the idea for Beast started to kind of germinate, was this sort of feeling of being pulled out of South Louisiana and trying to figure out like what it was that was trying to pull me back.
Now, for those who haven't seen it, the short film, how much does it echo Beasts of the Southern Wild?
They're very connected, you know, particularly from the people, you know, it was the people that I met making Gloriette who are in the film. You know, Gloriette is also all non-professional actors, you know, almost all from South Louisiana or New Orleans. And it was a lot of the people that were in that film that I was thinking of when I started just thinking that I want to make a film where holdouts are the heroes, you know, where the people that are fighting for this place are the heroes of the story, as opposed to the way that they were being framed either in the media or even just at dinner, you know, as people were sort of trying to convince me not to move there. And then I was sort of thinking about the future, you know, like what is it going to be like in the future, you know, when storms are just this constant presence. I started writing it during Gustav and Ike in 2008 and just imagining a future where this was every summer that the storms were coming. And so all of that definitely was kind of breathed out of Gloriette.
How is it that you finally get to do Beast?
Basically, I got back there. I went back down by myself, just like with a cane. And pretty soon after that, I got calls from the Sundance Labs who had seen Gloriette and asked me if I had a screenplay, which I had not started yet, but I lied and said that, of course I have a screenplay. What does it do? You know, they're like 3 weeks and then you just start typing. And then also CineReach, my financiers, who ended up paying for the entire film, also saw Gloriette and said, you know, what do you want to do next? If you can make a film in this budget range, we would love to pay for the whole thing. And
the budget range being?
The film ended up costing around $1.5 million, which was definitely, you know, at the top of what they wanted to do. But it was basically as long as you're not trying to make a blockbuster, if you're making a film that sort of emerges from the same world as Gloriette, which they'd seen and loved, they wanted to pay for the whole thing. And so those two things happened right in sync with each other.
So you get these calls. I mean, it sounds almost like your fairy godparents have now decided to come and visit. You bang out a script. Then you've never done a film of this length and magnitude. How do you go about figuring out? I mean, do you find somebody who's a line producer who can do budgets and crunch the numbers, or do you have enough experience on the job now to be able to say, I can do this?
Well, I have amazing producers. I mean, I have a huge team around me. I mean, that's part of it. We've all come up together making films in this very unconventional way, and almost everybody on the team is people that I'd worked with before, their friends and their family, and, you know, and they have experience doing things the way that we do them. And it wasn't like a free-for-all on Gloriette. We had budgets. You know, we had to deal with investors. So it wasn't like we completely didn't know what we were doing, but we were certainly very intentionally trying to not conform the method to something that was precedented. And we sort of almost even had a mandate from our financiers to make the film in an unprecedented way.
Coming up after a short break, Beasts of the Southern Wild director Ben Zeitlin plans to resist the lure of those beasts at the big Hollywood studios. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Kim Masters and this is The Business. In the 2008 election, and again this time, President Barack Obama's grassroots outreach proved to be a powerful force. And that lesson wasn't lost on filmmaker Ben Zeitlin. He adopted some of the same techniques to search for a child to play the lead role of Hush Puppy in his film Beasts of the Southern Wild.
The whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right. One piece bust, even the smallest piece, the entire universe will get busted.
Kwevenjine Wallace, now 9 years old, is a possible Oscar nominee for her performance in this movie that blends magical realism and drama. Her father was played by local baker Dwight Henry. Beasts of the Southern Wild is an unconventional film in so many ways that, of course, it wasn't something that could be easily pitched. But director Ben Zeitlin and his producers found financing through CineReach, a foundation and production company aimed at making films from underrepresented perspectives.
The way that our relationship with CineReach worked, they didn't need a genre, they didn't need stars, they didn't need a kind of conventional thing that guarantees you're going to get a box office return. They just had this totally creative agenda. It was miraculous. You
I was
know?
Just thinking something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you, you've told this story a bunch of times, this casting story, mm-hmm. but just to give it to us briefly again, because the leads, of course, are so extraordinary mm-hmm. in this film.
Yeah, the casting process was this massive grassroots search, and the way that I sort of have started making sense of it is basically all of our producers and a lot of our casting people in between Gloria Tsi and Beasts of the Southern Wild worked on the Obama campaign as grassroots organizers. And so we basically took the same method they were using to get out the vote to how we cast the film, which was we were traveling around South Louisiana, knocking on doors, passing out flyers, getting involved with church leaders in schools. And so we took 9 months as we were writing the film looking for, you know, who was going to save us and become the star. And then saw about 4,000 kids.
That's a lot of kids.
It's a lot of kids. You know, when you're trading in miracle-based logic, you actually have to work extremely hard. I think that's one of the lessons, is that you work and work and work, and then you increase your odds of the miraculous happening, which it did, finding Kwevenjine. And she's from this town called Houma, which is right near where we shot the film, which was another miracle, because she could go home every night and not have to live in somebody else's house. And so, you know, her mom was able to be on set every day and keep working and all that kind of stuff. So
she was, did she just jump out right away? Because I've seen pictures of her in mm-hmm. regular, she doesn't look like she does in the movie, she's...
Yeah. Yeah, no, she's nothing like that character. You know, even though we were using non-professional actors, we weren't looking for people that would just play themselves. We were looking for people who had acting talent. And that was what she had. I mean, she had just had an extraordinary ability to focus and sort of step into character, to the point where in our early rehearsals, I would be so convinced that she was actually scared or actually sad that I would consistently stop the scene and then she would just start laughing at me, that she tricked me. And she had a sense of right and wrong that was really important to Hush Puppy. And a lot of times I would ask her, you know, when I got confused about what Hush Puppy would do, a lot of times she would have clearer answers than me. So, yeah.
And Dwight Henry, who came first as far as the casting go? He's the baker who you cast as the father.
Yeah, she came first. And that was always, we knew we would have to build the cast out of her, especially her father, because we really had no idea what she would look like. The actual plan was to use a professional actor in the other role. And we tried out several people and it didn't really work. And then because we'd never done any casting for Wink in this grassroots way, you know, we didn't think that a non-professional could play the part. We sort of just kind of casually looked back and said, was there anybody that we saw at any point? And then we remembered that Dwight, who we were friends with because we would go to his donut shop every morning, had come in and done this tape for us, which I don't know that I'd even ever seen. And so I went back and looked at the tape and thought, wow, you know, this actually could maybe work. Like, his personal story and his life has so many things that relate to the story of the film that if he has the ability to channel those things into performance, he could really do this. And we went and tried it, and he could. And that was another kind of miraculous moment.
He wasn't really expecting, like, to be an actor.
No, I don't think anybody was. Nor were we expecting to be, you know, speaking on NPR. I mean, nobody really had any sense that this was some sort of professionally smart thing to be doing. It was it was something that people did for the fun of it and the passion for it. But yeah, I mean, to say that Dwight's bakery and his business certainly have always come first, and that was very clear when we cast him, you know. Basically, the way we got him to agree with it is that we told him that we could do all of our prep and all our rehearsals while he was baking donuts. And so we started doing all of our work from midnight until 6 a.m, baker's hours, you know, while he's rolling dough and frying donuts. And that allowed the bakery to stay open while the prep time. He actually took 2 months off to shoot the film, but it gave him time to train someone to take over his job.
Is he literally going from doing a donut to reading a line?
Those things were happening simultaneously. I mean, there was like jelly all over all of the scripts. You know, he would be cutting the donuts and looking at the script, and we'd have other people in the room playing the scenes with him, and I'd be there doing interviews with him.
Not Hush Puppy. She's a little
No,
kid.
She didn't work at night. This is what we did separate of her.
But you had no SAG issue because it wasn't a union movie.
Right.
And now that's become something of an issue in terms of awards. I don't even, do you just feel like, I can't even believe I'm here, so if they can't be eligible for a SAG award, I'm okay.
Yeah, basically. I mean, the movie was so far outside the industry, you know, when we were making it, that it was never really a thing. And it's, to me, it's actually a great moment. I mean, Dwight and Nazy are now eligible for SAG. They're becoming SAG members. So it's actually, as far as those things go, you know, I think... it's just amazing and surreal that all of us so far outside this are now actually getting to sort of participate in the film industry. It's totally crazy.
Is that an ambivalent thing?
No, I mean I love Hollywood films. You know, I mean I don't necessarily want to make them, but to sort of see this world and to have a film that was made like this be on the same stage as those kind of films, to me is great and. I want to keep on making movies the same way, but I feel like this can only help our ability to actually define the way that we want to work.
I mean, you work in such an unusual way that I actually wondered when I was reading about the way you made this movie, whether there's any part of you that worries that doing this, talking about it a lot and selling it and campaigning for it is going to somehow screw up the whole free process that went into making it in the first place.
There certainly is a narrative out there of like that's what happens to people that you are aware of, but I don't know. It's getting like corrupted in some way. It's not something I worry about. I mean, we have really such a strong, you know, our team is not all people that are film industry people. You know, our props people, our painters, our boat people, our boat builders, there's farmers. You know, there wasn't this ambition, and there still isn't this ambition to kind of grab at something out there. You know, I think for us, for all of us, I know that we're going to go back and it's going to be the same people and doing it for the same reasons. And it's just a matter of maintaining creative control, really, you know, which is, you know, the success of the film only helps that.
So what's the next project? And is it becoming, I mean, it's not challenge free, I gather.
I sort of am limiting what I'm going to say about it a little bit. No, I mean, when I got to Sundance, you know, I have a sort of, I don't know if everybody has this, but I have my little movie pile of movies that I need to make before I die. And so
I don't think everybody has that.
Well, I do anyway. And, you know, I assumed going to Sundance, I was like, okay, we're going to make the easiest one because I just want to get another film done as fast as possible. And when the film started to be successful, I thought, you know what, let's just go take the hardest one and do that one now, because who knows whether this moment will ever come along again where we have that kind of leverage to really do something insane. So it just seems like this is what I want to try, is just trying to make the most difficult thing that I can think of.
Ben Zeitlin is the filmmaker who made Beasts of the Southern Wild. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you. This is great.
Beasts of the Southern Wild comes out on DVD on December 4th. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.